Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Latin American Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Elena McGrath. With me today is Sarah Hines. Sarah is an assistant professor of history at the University of Oklahoma. She's here to talk with me today about her book, Water for All, Community, Property, and Revolution in Modern Bolivia, out this year from the University of California Press. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Elena.
Can you tell the audience a little bit about your background and how you came to write this book specifically?
Yes, absolutely. I first became interested in the topic of Latin American social movements and struggles around water when I was a college student and activist in New York City in the late 90s and early 2000s. And this was during the time of the global justice movement, when social movements around the world were challenging inequality and the policies of powerful financial institutions like the World Bank. And as I got involved in activism, first as a college student and then as a high school teacher, I began to learn about social movements in Latin America, like the Zapatistas in Chiapas, Mexico, and movements against water privatization in Bolivia that were having a lot of success. And at the time, I was interested and involved in social movements in the U.S. that seemed to be losing. The global justice movement tanked after 9/11. The movements against the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq didn't prevent those wars from happening. The fight against gay marriage at the time seemed like an uphill battle. And I was also involved in the reform movement in the New York City Teachers Union that was having very little success. So I wanted to understand what made social movements effective and why Latin American social movements were so much, seemed to be so much more successful than those in the United States at the time. So I started studying Spanish while I was still a college student. I traveled to Chiapas with a university delegation to do solidarity work. And I wrote my senior thesis on labor organizing during the Bracero program. The Bracero program was a contract labor program that started during World War II that brought Mexican men to work in U.S. agriculture. At the time I was writing and researching the thesis in 2001 and 2002, the Mexican and U.S. governments were engaged in negotiations about reviving this kind of a program. And so I got interested in looking at the relationship between Mexican braceros, as they were called, and U.S. Domestic agricultural workers and the relationships between them, and found that they ended up often bridging the divides that were constructed between them by growers and state bureaucrats. So after college, I taught social studies at a high school in the Bronx in New York. I continued my activist work and I kept paying attention to Latin America. And this was the early 2000s. So when Bolivians overthrew their president in 2003 in protests against gas exports, I became very curious to learn more. And I'd already become interested in Bolivia at the time of the 2000 water war in Cochabamba, when a broad social movement overturned water privatization there. So in the summer of 2004, I traveled to Bolivia to study Spanish and talk with activists there while I was still a high school teacher. And at the time, of all the social movements in the world that were fighting water, that were fighting neoliberal policies like water privatization, Bolivia's were among the most successful. And that success began with the fight over water privatization in Cochabamba in the year 2000. So after teaching high school for 4 years, I spent a year in Bolivia with a Fulbright grant, carrying out an oral history project on social movements in Cochabamba in the early 2000s, and particularly focusing on the role of state tin miners who had been fired in the 1980s with policies that came with neoliberal economic reform practices. So when I began a PhD program in history at the University of California, Berkeley in 2007, I planned to study some aspect of Bolivia's labor and social movement history. And while I thought I might write a history of mine workers or the capital city La Paz during the 1952 Bolivian Revolution, my attention kept getting pulled back to water. And the more I looked at historical documents and talked with people, the more I realized that social struggle over water did not begin with the privatization effort in the late 1990s, but rather that it had a long history that helped to explain, or that I thought probably helped to explain, why the movement against water privatization had been so powerful and successful in the year 2000. So I ultimately decided to write my dissertation on the history of social struggle over water property and access in Bolivia, with a focus on the Cochabamba region. And that dissertation, which I finished in 2015, became the basis for my book, Water for All.
In this book, you argue that Cochabamba is what you call a popular hydraulic society, where water users have successfully exerted, in your words, a common claim to collective control over water resources. Can you unpack what this means for listeners and think about what it tells us about the social and political and economic landscape of the region, or waterscape, as it were?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, historical studies of hydraulic engineering projects have tended to take a top-down approach. They often portray water users and environments as either victims or passive beneficiaries of powerful states or private capital. And they often focus exclusively on state and professional engineers and water managers, and don't consider the expertise and knowledge of ordinary water users. And this perspective is best represented by Carl Wittfogel and Donald Worster, who both studied irrigation and politics in arid environments. Wittfogel studied irrigation systems in China. Donald Worster studied the development of water infrastructure and power dynamics in the U.S. West. And Wittfogel in the 1950s argued that building large-scale irrigation systems required centralized state administration to build and maintain those systems, and therefore inevitably led to despotic political regimes in arid environments. And Donald Worster applied this thesis to the U.S. West, where he found that powerful state institutions and wealthy elites dominated and exploited the land and other people by controlling water sources. And while these kinds of outcomes are possible and have no doubt occurred, whether in China or the U.S. West or other places, what I take issue with in this perspective is the deterministic idea that the development of irrigation systems in arid environments inevitably produces despotism. I mean, I'm not the first to make this point by any stretch. And what I argue in Cochabamba is that, in contrast, providing water in a semi-arid environment didn't lead to or require authoritarianism, but rather in Cochabamba, ordinary water users won access to a range of water sources and systems in various ways through their labor, through their knowledge, and through their social struggle. So that rather than falling victim to state builders and experts, Cochabambinos built what I call, a popular hydraulic society in the 20th century. And I think it'll become more clear what that means as we get into the history itself. But just to give a brief overview, the book begins in the 1870s when a small group of landowners did control the bulk of the region's water sources, which included especially mountain lakes and mountainside springs and seasonal rivers that flowed from those lakes. And the rest of the book traces the efforts of a broad array of actors from estate workers on haciendas, large estates, to independent peasants called piqueros, to city residents in neighborhoods on the urban periphery, to residents of the city center, and also includes state engineers, and their efforts to democratize water access, access to drinking water and irrigation water in particular. And it shows that by the time of the 2000 water war, Cochabambinos had significantly democratized water access and established a significant measure of popular control over water sources and infrastructure, and even over hydraulic planning and policy. And this is not to romanticize the situation or say that there weren't also inequalities, but that there was a significant democratization of water access and participation in planning and policy over those 100 or more years. And related to this, many scholars have found that high modernist water infrastructure projects like dams have ignored local people, their history, their knowledge, and local ecology. And this is no doubt true in many cases. Think dam projects that displace large numbers of people in India or Egypt or the U.S.'s Tennessee Valley, for instance. But in Cochabamba, in contrast, I found that water users have been able to draw on their own history and knowledge and desires to craft alternative visions of modernity. So rather than placing Cochabamba's water escape, both its public water system and its more autonomous water systems outside of modernity, I argue that they're very much part of modernity, but a more democratic bottom-up version.
I mean, I think that many people who are listening, or at least those of us who were searching as you were for examples of sort of successful social movements around the turn of the 21st century, are going to have remembered the Cochabamba water wars or Bolivia and the wars over water and gas as these moments of sort of shocking transformation or unrest against a globalization. But what your book does is really show how this is a much, much longer conflict. And you argue that if we're going to look farther back, these watershed moments, as you say, one of them is going to be the revolution of 1952.
First, it's important to say that the 2000 water war in Cochabamba was indeed a huge turning point in Bolivian and even global politics. In Bolivia, it opened a five-year period of mass mobilization that brought down two presidents, discredited neoliberal economic policies, and led in 2005 to the election of the country's first indigenous president, Evo Morales. And at the time, in those years, Cochabamba water protesters called for a constituent assembly that would refound the nation on the basis of democratic access to and control over natural resources like water and others. And Morales, in his campaign and in his inauguration speeches, promised to hold such an assembly and made good on that promise as president. So in many ways, all of that flowed from, no pun intended, this initial successful struggle against water privatization in 2000 after many years of other privatizations that had not been halted by social protest. So in Cochabamba, the water war returned water provision to the municipal water utility. It returned it to peri-urban neighborhoods, and it returned water provision to rural irrigation systems who had managed it before privatization. And there are many wonderful studies of the water war itself, its aftermath in the period in the late 80s and 90s, where neoliberal approaches took hold in Bolivia. But this deeper history of social struggle over water is really important to understand the struggle itself and what produced the water systems and rights regimes that privatization arrived to transform. And this history is bound up with larger historical processes like the dispossession and dismantling of indigenous communities, the 1952 revolution, as you say, and the dictatorships of the 60s and 70s. So digging back into historical records and newspapers and doing interviews with water users in different parts of the region showed me that social struggle over water access in Cochabamba and in Bolivia more generally had this longer and quite dramatic history. And it showed, and what I argue in the book, is that Cochabambinos succeeded in overturning water privatization in the 2000 water war because they were defending something that they had already won over decades of organizing, and that being popular control over water sources and provision. And so whereas water was controlled by a small number of water owners in the late 19th century, by the late 20th century, a wide array of groups owned and controlled it and its provision and water policy. So by 1999, water users in the valley had come to consider themselves the owners of the region's water sources and systems. And interestingly, many of the valley's autonomous water systems, both in the agricultural areas and in the outskirts of the city, are relatively recent inventions. So whereas we might assume that the communitarian water systems are artifacts of some ancient past, in Cochabamba, many are new. And of course, all water systems, like all relationships between people and their environments, are evolving creations. Some irrigation systems do have their roots in pre-colonial times. But even those have changed quite significantly over time.
Let's go back to where your book starts, which is in the 1870s, and this El Nino related drought, and we can talk about kind of how water figured into hacienda expansion and dispossession and land tenure changes that were happening then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well. Water dispossession absolutely functioned as a tool, first of colonial violence and then later post-colonial violence. In the late 19th century, owners of large landed estates called haciendas, who were descendants of Spanish conquistadors gained control over almost all of the region's water sources. And this process had begun in the colonial period when Spanish settlers and their descendants appropriated land, water sources, and irrigation infrastructure from indigenous populations through a combination of purchases, theft, and rural grants. But despite that dispossession, indigenous communities held on to much of their land and water sources into the independence period. But in the late 1870s, at the beginning of the liberal period, the national government took advantage of a severe drought and the famine, disease, and death it produced to break up indigenous communities' collective land holdings. And since water rights are tied to land, this process also led to the privatization of collective water rights. So the state came along and titled individual families' land holdings and the associated water rights, but then sold off the so-called excess land and excess water rights to large landowners. So this involved, this was a huge dispossession of indigenous communities and also led to their demise because now there was no longer collective land and water holding. And at the same time, the national government implemented a riparian system of water rights, which meant that water sources that were located within a particular private property or flowed through it belonged to the landowner. So the combined effects of these processes meant that a small group of landowners monopolized the region's most important water sources by the end of the 1800s, even more than they had during the colonial period.
So let's go back and talk about your conversation about high and low forms of modernist development, because one of the things that starts happening in Bolivia in the turn of the 20th century is this idea of the government starting to think, well, we need to change some things. We need to democratize some things about the state. And one of the things that your book argues is that there was a water reform that preceded the land reform that was part of early populist projects in the aftermath of the Chaco War, for example. And so what did the state try to do in the 1930s and what actually happened to transform water use?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really important question. After the Chaco War, the traditional mining, land-owning political class was completely discredited because of the loss of Bolivia to Paraguay in the Chaco War and the huge loss of life in that war. And in the wake of the war, reformist governments called military socialist governments of mid-ranking military officers came to power. These military socialist governments of David Toro and Herman Busch wanted to develop the national economy by starting with increasing agricultural production. Trying to start with something that was Bolivia's strength in order to ultimately move toward other forms of economic development. But they weren't willing to redistribute land to accomplish. They did try to make water more accessible to small farmers and large estate owners through large-scale hydraulic development projects, and also through some very limited purchases of water sources from estate owners. And this effort began in Cochabamba, the country's largest agricultural region. So the idea was that with greater water access, both large estates and small farmers could increase agricultural production because they could plant twice a year and have better production. So to make water more accessible to farmers, the military socialists first nationalized a range of water sources. In the new 1938 Constitution, the Constitution federalized rivers, marshes, and medicinal waters, as well as, in the Constitution's words, all of the physical forces available or able to be used for economic purposes. Mm-hmm. Then in 1939, President Bush invited Mexican state engineers to design and build a large irrigation dam in Cochabamba called the Angostura Project. And the dam itself ended up being named the Presa Mexico after the Mexican engineers and the Mexican state who had designed and funded it. So Bush and his ministers were interested in doing something like what Cárdenas, the president of Mexico at the time in the 1930s, had done there. During his presidency, the Mexican state redistributed 45 million acres of land, and the National Irrigation Commission there built a series of dams to increase the productivity of redistributed agricultural land. And so Bush invited Mexican state engineers to come and design and build the Angostura Dam in Cochabamba, which was to be the centerpiece of a new state-built and state-managed national irrigation system. And they were drawn to this Cardenista model of state-led reform aimed at economic diversification, greater agricultural productivity, and uplift of the rural poor. But they wanted those benefits without, there's some quote, something along the lines of 10 years of Pancho Villa. They wanted that, they wanted all of that without the 10 years of violence of the Mexican
Revolution. They didn't want to reproduce that part of the Mexican Revolution, sure.
Yeah. In the end, they ended up getting both, but they didn't know that. So the other side of this was providing greater water supply to the growing city of Cochabamba, the department's capital, where residents were protesting water scarcity and unequal access as the urban population was growing, as people were migrating to the city after the Chaco War. So to end the state of affairs, the government tried to increase water access in the state capital. The state government expropriated water sources from three seasonal rivers that supplied a handful of large estates and somewhere in the order of 800 small farmers. And this is one of my favorite sources that I found in the course of my research. Thankfully, it was preserved in the state archive, the record of this project and attempted expropriation. So in the record, the landowners write against the proposal, saying that this is going to hurt hurt food production in the countryside. But small farmers, independent landowners known as piqueros, offered a particularly sharp critique of the expropriation on the basis of existing water inequality, explaining to the state government that they were forced to rent water from their wealthy hacendado neighbors, who not only had far more land than they did, but also had water rights to spare. And so there was a water market in the countryside that the state government was probably aware of, but they, on this basis, the piqueros opposed this expropriation. And they proposed instead that the state of government expropriate the Chapisirca lakes, which belonged to the heirs of Daniel Salamanca, who was the president who had, by now deceased by 1940, who had led Bolivia to war with Chile, with Paraguay in the Chaco in the early 1930s. And the incredible thing about this is that the prefecture complied with the piqueros request.
So that's such a great example of popular knowledge and popular projects sort of intervening. That's fabulous.
Absolutely. And the pressure and influence that ordinary, supposedly powerless people can have at a time of social upheaval and unrest and political crisis. But at this, while all of this was significant, these reforms in terms of these large-scale hydraulic projects and this, while limited but also significant expropriation, all of this was aimed at avoiding redistribution of land and water through and avoiding expropriations of land and water. And the governments, the national government and the state government, hoped that these kinds of dam projects could capture water that was not being used and channel it to farmers, both large and small. But in the end, this was not enough to quell the water demands of piqueros or city dwellers, or ultimately hacienda laborers known as colonos. So despite these reforms, Cochabamba's water monopoly mostly endured, and hacendados retained ownership of most of the region's water sources in the 1940s.
So this brings us up to the 52 revolution, and I really like the way your book sort of positions this moment as a hydraulic revolution, because so much of the way that scholars tend to talk about the Bolivian revolution, and with good reason, is, you know, land to those who work it, mines to the state, and universal suffrage, and these sorts of things. But water is caught up in all of that. And I want to go back to something you said earlier, which is that these colonos have a memory of building the infrastructure, right? If this infrastructure is recent, then the people who have built the infrastructure mostly are still living there, and they are water users, and they are using this to sort of justify their claims, to create a political claim on the state. So let's look at the 52 revolution and think about how this changes the way we think about agrarian reform processes.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, the chapter on the revolution is the most important chapter in the book because it shows that water redistribution was a major demand of both city residents and rural farmers, especially the colonos, the estate workers, and that it was also a major accomplishment of the revolution. So after the 52 revolution, rural estate workers' main demand, as you said, was famously land for those who work it. In other words, they demanded expropriation and redistribution of land hoarded by estate owners that they had worked for a pittance for generations. But focusing on water in these cases shows that colonos also demanded water for those who use it. And their demands were based, as you say, not only on the need to irrigate the plots that they won through agrarian reform, or that they were trying to win through agrarian reform, but also on their historic labor. And in these cases and in interviews I did with elders in the communities where the reforms happened, they pointed to the fact that their forebears had built the dams and canals that stored and channeled water to the haciendas, and that their ancestors and that they themselves had been repairing and maintaining them ever since. And this is a matter of just a few generations. A lot of these dams had been built in the in the final years of the 19th century, the early years of the 20th century, and we're talking about 1953. So this is two or at most three generations previous that colonos had built these dams. And then every year they were going up to the dams and the canals to repair them and maintain them. So the chapter draws on interviews with elders from these communities and transcripts of agrarian reform cases to show that agrarian reform involved not only land redistribution, but also redistribution of irrigation water sources. And as a result, unions formed by former colonos came to control some of the region's most important lakes, seasonal rivers, and springs. And I came to look into this because I didn't understand at first why now, well, the now was then 2011, more or less, why the municipal water company was negotiating with communities of irrigators or ex-colonial unions over very important, the largest lakes in the mountains outside of the city. And at some point, I don't really remember quite how, I got a transcript of one of these cases as part of the research I was doing on the recent past and present. And so that took me to the Agrarian Reform, the Institute of the Agrarian Reform archive, where I found on these cases and found a wealth of information about the redistribution of these water sources. Also, it's important to note that in the revolutionary period, city dwellers were mobilizing for greater water access as well. And one of my favorite examples, a brigade of 200 workers climbed the mountainside to protest delays in a project that was meant to bring more water to the city. And they took the project over from municipal workers, working 12 hours a day for 2 days, dynamiting open canals to connect two additional lakes to the city's water system. So that's, you know, the sort of popular labor and hydraulic expertise that you find in this history. So paying attention to water shows that agrarian reform revolutionized the nation's water tenure regime, dispossessing hacendados of water sources that they had until then legally owned and instead delivering them to former estate workers. But these colonos, the estate workers, were much more successful than independent peasants, the piqueros, or city dwellers in gaining increased water, which meant that the MNR's promise, the party that led the revolution, the movement of the National Revolution, its promise to provide water for all was remained only partially fulfilled by the end of the revolutionary period in the early 1960s.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
what happens after the MNR government falls to military dictatorship? So in 1964, you have the MNR overthrown by General Barrientos. And like many, like some other revolutionary era reforms, these governments don't immediately dismantle water rights, right? This is not an immediate move to privatization in 64. So what happens?
Yeah, not at all. And unlike in Guatemala or Chile, the dictatorships didn't overthrow or overturn the agrarian reform of the 1952 revolution. They didn't do a lot to continue it, but they didn't shut it down. In many cases, continued after the 1964 coup. So during these dictatorships in the 60s and 70s, water users that had been left out of those revolutionary era redistribution programs tried to make good on this revolutionary promise of water for all. So in this period, it's important to note, Latin America went from a primarily rural region to a majority urban region. I mean, that was the case in Bolivia as well, such that many new urban neighborhoods on the outskirts of cities like Cochabamba were left out of municipal water systems and lacked other public services. And this had always been the case, that there were areas left out of the municipal water systems, but that situation became even more exaggerated as cities grew. So one of the main changes in the 60s and 70s was the arrival of powerful development banks to the region. In Bolivia, the Inter-American Development Bank began to provide loans for water supply expansion projects, but those loans came with conditions. One was that new water supply come from deep wells in the countryside rather than lakes and rather than dam projects in the mountains. And this was because the logic was there could be greater control over aquifer water that could be transferred to the city in pipes rather than through open air canals. And another condition was that the municipality found a new water company that would raise rates to achieve what they called cost recovery. So they wanted to end subsidies for urban water provision. Water users in Cochabamba had other ideas. By this point, the main water users in the valley were ex-colono communities, piqueros, peri-urban neighborhoods, and city center residents who were customers of this now refounded municipal water company, CEMAPA was its name, and still is. They all lacked sufficient water to meet their needs and fulfill their desires. And they all began to rally behind a dam project in the mountains called the Misikuni Project. So in 1975, a caravan of 1,000 residents traveled up the mountainside to the project site by the Misikuni River to demand that the government carry out feasibility studies. So these kinds of protests and demands pushed the government, starting under the dictator Hugo Banzer in the 70s, to fund studies for the project, and ultimately to start building the dam itself in the 1990s. And this is an example of the kind of vernacular modernist project pushed from below that I was talking about before, rather than the impetus coming from above or from outside. And during these years, municipal customers successfully fought rate hikes through payment strikes and other means. And in the countryside, when CEMAPA, the water company, tried to drill deep wells that would interfere with shallow irrigation wells, irrigators successfully organized to stop them, winning concessions of different kinds, including wells for themselves. During these years, growing peri-urban communities built their own water systems as the municipal water system continued to leave them outside its network. They often purchased water sources from former estate owners and agrarian reform beneficiaries, and they built infrastructure with their own funds and labor. And very importantly, this new water company, CEMAPA, grew in terms of its reach by making agreements with these neighborhoods, incorporating them into the municipal water network in exchange for their water sources and infrastructure. So CEMAPA was very much built by urban neighborhoods, residents of urban neighborhoods themselves. And these fights over rates in the city center and over wells in the countryside continued into the neoliberal period of the late 1980s and the 1990s. And often these fights over water access pitted urban and rural customers against each other. And they also pitted CEMAPA customers against the company CEMAPA, as the Inter-American Development Bank urged CEMAPA to raise rates. So interestingly, many of these groups of water users had opposed CEMAPA's policies in the decades before privatization.
So this is a much longer struggle against for control, actually, rather than just against a certain kind of development.
Mm-hmm.
So then when Bolivia returns to a kind of civilian democracy, this is actually the moment in which the government is able to dismantle a lot of the infrastructure of the revolutionary state, right? So what happens in the 80s and in the 90s, and how did the privatization fight transform water use?
Neoliberal water policy aimed to privatize water utilities, and that as is well known. But that was just one component of a much broader effort to dispossess the population of water sources and systems, as well as the social right to participate in water management and hydraulic engineering that they had won over the previous three decades since the 1952 revolution. So the fight in 1999 and 2000 over water privatization was the culmination of decades of social struggle over water access, over rate hikes, over deep well drilling, and other policies. And as the slogan, "The Water is Ours," of the Water War suggests, during the Water War, water users in Cochabamba were not only defending a state-owned municipal company, that company that they had actually been fighting in various ways for the previous two or three decades. They were also defending a wide range of water sources and systems that various communities of water users owned and controlled. So to put your question a different way, I think the reason that the national government under a now elected President Banzer in the late 1990s wanted to privatize water was because not only he, but all of the major political parties, including the MNR, had accepted the logic of neoliberalism. That public sector institutions were hopelessly and inevitably inefficient and corrupt, that water was a natural monopoly, and therefore autonomous water systems were inefficient and backwards, that private foreign companies were, in contrast, efficient and effective, and that private companies, foreign consultants, and international development banks, rather than water users themselves, knew best about how to administer water. But what they failed to consider was this long history of social struggle over water in Cochabamba. And ultimately, privatization failed because of this history, because water users in Cochabamba had engineered the region's water sources and systems and had fought for decades to democratize access to them. So water privatization raised rates astronomically after three decades of mostly successful efforts of Semakwa customers to keep them low. Water privatization dispossessed the public of a municipal water company whose water sources and systems they had partially built and paid for over many decades. Water privatization dispossessed neighborhoods on the outskirts of the city of water sources and systems that they had entirely paid for and charged them to use them. Water privatization dispossessed small farmers, including ex-colonial agricultural communities, of water sources and systems that they had built and paid for, built and maintained for generations. And in the case of colonos, had fought a revolution to win. And the water privatization scheme would have replaced the Misikuni project with another project against the wishes of the local population who had fought for this project for 30 years. So the water privatization fight and the successful struggle against it, or the success in defeating water privatization, returned the state of affairs to what it had been before 1999, but in many ways re-empowered, gave Cochabambinos a new sense of their own power that they had lost in a lot of ways over the past 15 years of democratic return, where a restored democracy was a much more impoverished democracy than the democracy they had fought for in the revolution and that they had fought for during two decades of dictatorship. And so it was only really with the water war and the successful fight against privatization that Cochabambinos and Bolivians who supported them found again a sense of their power from below to construct a democracy where they had a say in what policies that affected their lives look like.
Thank you for that answer. That's really helpful. And so I guess my next question would be, since you said that it kind of returned, on the one hand, it returned things to the status quo, but on the other hand, it enabled kind of what came next, right? It enabled a new way of imagining political participation. So what is the status of, what is water access like in Cochabamba now, and what has changed?
Yeah, it's such an important question. Because when Aguas Tutunari, the company that was handed over, that was handed the provision of water in Cochabamba left 22 years ago, there were still real problems to solve that privatization didn't. And one was that there's so many people who are left out of the municipal water network who pay sometimes as much as 20 times the amount that municipal customers pay for water, to buying it from private water providers who fill up their tanks in the water-rich northern neighborhoods of the city and sell it dear in the dry southern neighborhoods. So everyone recognized that there were still real problems to solve. SEMAPA's new governance structure included community representatives, and at first there were elected community representatives in SEMAPA, but that sort of fell off after a few years. As social movements demobilized a bit. And then after the election of the Morales government, there began to be a tension between the Morales government's desire to centralize control over water provision and autonomous water users' efforts and desires to maintain that kind of local control over water sources and systems. So for instance, in the neighboring municipality of Sacaba, right next door to Cochabamba, the MAS-led, Evo Morales's party, the MAS, the MAS-led public water company tried to absorb water cooperatives into the municipal water system and use their water sources and infrastructure for the broader region. But cooperative members argue that they had purchased these water sources and built this infrastructure with their own labor and funds, so they didn't have any reason to turn it over to the municipality or share those sources with their newly arrived neighbors. So these kinds of tensions between water users who possess either historic rights or who possess water infrastructure and sources, there have been tensions between them and those who don't have those kind of rights. I'm actually in Cochabamba right now. I've been here for about 2 months. And when I arrived, I was curious to find out whether water from the Misikuni Reservoir that has since been completed since the last time I was here a few years ago, whether it had arrived to the Zona Sud, the southern zone of the city that was most waiting for it in the city. And so I found, talking to different folks at the Empresa Misikuni and at SEMAPA and in neighborhoods, that the Misikuni water, the Misikuni company is preparing to deliver water to neighborhoods in the Zona Sud, and the municipal water company SEMAPA will administer water in most Zona Sud neighborhoods. So there's going to be sort of a combination of the municipal water company delivering Misikuni water to most of the Zona Sud neighborhoods, and then other neighborhoods that don't want anything to do with SEMAPA receiving water directly from the Misikuni company because of these sort of historic, this historic distrust on the part of some of the Zona Sud neighborhoods, their distrust of the water company, SEMAPA. One of the biggest issues now is that is the question of distribution. SEMAPA has built 8 new distribution networks, but is still looking for financing to build 5 more. So while water is set to arrive in some neighborhoods of the Zona Sud in the next few months, the network doesn't reach the hardest to reach or the furthest southern neighborhoods. And the region's other municipalities are even less prepared to distribute water from Misikuni. Another side of this is that irrigators in the countryside complain that Misikuni water is going to the city for human consumption and not to their fields, even though this was always historically called the Proyecto Múltiple Misikuni, that this was supposed to be a multiple project in the sense of it was supposed to provide water for not only drinking water, but also hydroelectricity and irrigation. And a contact of mine at the Empresa Misikuni has said that these rural communities are going to have to wait until the second or the third phase of the project when 2 additional dams are built before they're going to receive water. And then finally, giving a sense of how this history continues to play out, SEMAPA is on the verge of implementing a new rate structure that threatens to increase water rates for half of its customers. So it's not only private companies that try to increase rates, but also the municipal company, despite this long history of its users fighting for subsidized water, is still trying to raise rates now 50 years after the first rate hike fights in the 1970s. So in a lot of ways, this history continues to play out, but there at the same time, there's a real sense that equity matters, that historic rights matter, and that some sort of mechanisms for including the perspectives and demands of water-using constituencies matter in the formulation of public policy. And there are ways that that's falling short, but other ways that the state government and the municipal water company are incorporating those demands and participation in their actions.
So the struggles continue, but there's still always. All right. So my next question is, in Bolivia, you talk about insurgent citizens, popular vernacular modernists engaging in environmental governance and claiming their own expertise, and more than anything, a profound tradition of popular demands over natural resources. So my question is Bolivia unique in this respect, or can this history of Cochabamba's popular hydraulic society help us understand the way water politics works and social struggle work in other places as well?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I get nervous about making claims about how representative or unique Cochabamba's history is, it requires more knowledge of other places' history than I feel I have. But I think I can say that water monopoly and water scarcity and protests over water access have been particularly intense in Bolivia, and within Bolivia, particularly intense in Cochabamba, probably more than in most places in the region or in the world. But that said, there are plenty of examples of social struggle over water access in the recent past and in deeper history in other parts of the world as well. And for me, what Cochabamba's history teaches us is that history matters and that distribution matters. Distribution of water sources themselves, first and foremost, but also the distribution of power over water infrastructure, over hydraulic engineering, and over water policy. So just like other features of the environment, water sources and systems have histories that are bound up with people's labor and power struggles, and how water flows through a landscape and who has access to it are the result of historical processes shaped by power relations, inequalities, and social mobilization. And also for me, it suggests, this history suggests that water rights need to be flexible and continuously reallocated through democratic and inclusive processes, especially in urbanizing areas when needs are changing in ways that don't necessarily match up with existing rights regimes. And so in the face of these kinds of difficult questions and issues, Cochabamba water activists have proposed founding a new coordinating body like the one that organized the protests in 2000 that could make these sort of tough decisions, trying to respect both historic water rights and present day needs. This kind of a body would be made up of representatives of different constituencies of water users, ex-colonial agricultural unions, irrigators unions, peri-urban neighborhoods, city center residents, the water company SEMAPA, state representatives. And such a body could also decide what role the state would play in this process. So ultimately, equitable distribution requires acting according. But stepping back from all of this, I think equitable redistribution or distribution requires acting according to a radical politics of solidarity, where some with excess rights and maybe perhaps excess power cede their rights, their historic water rights, but also perhaps some of their social power to those without water access and without water rights according to need. So this history is very important. Who has access to what water and how they've won it through social struggle. But this might not take into account the needs of those in the present.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think many, many people in a lot of places can relate to the challenges of scarce water supplies and changing water use being something that needs to be renegotiated constantly and also equitably.
Absolutely.
I think that is a pretty profound lesson in democratic water governance. Well, so my final question is just what's next for you now that this fabulous book has come out? Where are you interested in going next?
Yeah, I'm starting a new project on the social, political, cultural, and environmental history of glaciers in Bolivia, focusing on the Cordillera Real outside of La Paz. And I'm interested in looking at this history because, of course, we're living at a time when climate change is causing glaciers to retreat. But yet we don't know a lot about how different groups have interacted with glaciers over the long term or over the impacts of climate on their environments and their lives over the long term. And I'm particularly interested in looking at the relationship of rural Aymara communities with glaciers, who revere them as what they call the mother of the waters, the source of all the waters of the region. And speaking, as we were earlier, of water dispossession as colonial and post-colonial violence, in the Altiplano, unequal power relations have shaped by anti-Indigenous racism have led to unequal access to these sources and control over these sources, glacier-fed water sources and systems, as state institutions have channeled more and more water from the mountains to the capital city of La Paz. But like in Cochabamba, I expect to find that Aymara communities have not only been victims of these kinds of policies and dispossession, but have also very much been protagonists in the building and modification of water systems. And they've maintained their relationships with glaciers based on reciprocity and reverence as glaciers have retreated, maintaining these relationships with the glaciers that remain.
That's such an important story. I'm very excited to hear that you're taking that on. Yeah, I can't wait to see what you come up with.
Thanks.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah. And I really appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to talk to us about your book.
Thanks so much for inviting me.